Is it unusual for people to just up and disappear? In St. Charles County, that's not something that happens every day.
You have unexplained car accidents and the spouse going missing.
Without a body, we cannot conduct a criminal investigation.
I took the skull out of the water with my bare hands.
It was nothing I'd ever experienced before.
A shocking murder becomes a dark mystery. The victim's body holds the key to convicting the killer. Every fiber is a clue. Every wound is a piece of the puzzle. In these cases, it's up to the medical examiner to find the crucial evidence and catch the murderer. This is Secrets of the Morgue.
St. Charles is right across the river from St. Louis. It is a very, very small town, which eventually just grew and evolved.
In the 80s, it was country life, a lot of farmland. Very low homicide rate, maybe one or two a year.
On a fall evening, the calm of the countryside is violently interrupted.
Someone had called on the CB radio and reported that a vehicle had ran off the road.
The car had gone down the ravine. The engine was still on, and there was a small fire on the driver's side.
I walked up to the edge of the embankment next to the car, and I was able to climb down maybe 3 or 4 feet where the door was open and climb into the car. Could hear some gurgling noise or some gasping. And then I saw that there was a lady laying on her back, and she was stuffed up underneath the dash. And I noticed there was a break in the windshield. When I first called out to her, I got no response. I knew that she was in distress of some kind. So I tried to open her airway so that she could breathe. It was at that point that I noticed a great deal of injury to the back of her head. She actually had a wig on. Her wig had kind of tilted forward, and that allowed for me to feel the back of her head. It's kind of mushy. Trying to remove this lady from under the dashboard and passing her out of the car to the paramedics. Just nothing I'd ever experienced before.
Paramedics rush the injured woman to the hospital while detectives try to find out who she is.
One of the firemen had actually handed me her purse. She was identified through her driver's license as Sharon Williams.
Sharon Williams is a 43-year-old mother of 2 grown sons. She's active in her local church and is well known in the community.
We contacted the Williams residence and spoke with Sharon's husband, Jim, and told him about his wife being involved in an accident. Jim was transported to the hospital by the patrol officer.
Hospital staff work through the night, but Sharon's injuries are too extensive.
The next morning, Jim, her husband, decided to take her off life support. And that's when she died. The sheriff said Sharon died due to the accident.
But there was just some question in the officers' minds that there was more to it than just a simple motor vehicle crash.
Deputy Copeland pores over Sharon Williams' accident reconstruction report, trying to make sense of it.
An accident reconstructionist is generally a police officer who has specialized training in recreating the circumstances and the variables that take place during the course of a car accident. Using things like drag coefficients and other scientific formulas to try and determine how fast the vehicle was traveling at the time of impact, where was the impact?
The accident reconstruction showed that the vehicle had traveled along a small ravine, impacted with a tree, and the occupant wound up under the dash when the car impacted the bottom of the creek. That was totally inconsistent with what I believed. I felt that the car had not traveled off-road at such a speed that would have caused her to have these injuries.
The deputy had seen the car, and he said it was only a little ding in the front.
But the reconstruction report was accepted by the sheriff, and the accident in and of itself was just kind of put to rest.
Sharon is buried, and the case is closed.
I still had strong beliefs that Sharon received her injuries in a manner other than that motor vehicle accident. But that was just something that I had to live with.
Deputy Copeland is haunted by the case for 3 years. Until a new heavyweight chief medical examiner comes to town.
I was called by a detective in the St. Charles Sheriff's Department asking me if I would look at an old case. I remember him coming in and he's got a pile like that. And I'm like, okay, this'll take me a few days.
Dr. Case is one of just 15 specialists in the country, trained in both neuropathology and forensic pathology.
I'm always looking, if you want to say through a jaundiced eye, is there something abnormal here? Is there something that might be unnatural? There are very subtle ways that people can kill each other. And unless you examine them and do scene investigations, you won't know that.
Dr. Case starts digging into Sharon's medical files and discovers that she never received an autopsy.
She is taken to St. Joseph's Hospital in St. Charles, and she survives with this head injury for 11 hours before she dies, and then she is buried. What I got from the medical records was that, in this case, there was not a proper investigational activity because they didn't understand how to do that. Doctors in emergency rooms are not forensically trained, so this demonstrates the need to have proper forensic examination.
It's up to Dr. Case to determine whether Sharon died as a result of an accident, or if something more sinister is at play.
So Sharon's story is that she was driving a fairly big, heavy car, and she drove off the side of the road. There was not a huge impact, but the car is standing up, and she was deeply unconscious. So you could see on x-ray and on CT scan. The skull fracture was to the back of her head. There were no other injuries to her body other than she had a small abrasion on the left side of her forehead and a small laceration on the right side. So So this is an accident that is a frontal impact, and yet the massive damage that has caused her to die is from impact to the back of her head. So I'm thinking, that makes it very suspicious. I get back with the detective and I say, I need to exhume this body.
Dr. Case suspects Sharon Williams' death is not what it seems, and that the secret of how she died is buried with her.
I write a letter to the state's attorney. I say what the evidence is that I have and that I need to exhume this body, and will he give this information to the judge so I can get a court order? Well, I never hear back. So I call and I finally am able to talk to that man, and he simply says, I'm not doing that. Nobody could make this man move.
After 5 months of stonewalling, Dr. Case takes matters into her own hands.
In this case, it was a very strong forensic feeling. I believed this woman had been killed. But I decided to perform an illegal exhumation. The mother of Sharon Williams was still alive, and I called her. I told her what was, if you think about it, a very shocking story. That I believe that your daughter Sharon's death was not from a car accident. She does not legally have the right to give me this permission, but I want to have a little permission before I go over there and dig a hole in the ground. She had no hesitation in giving me this permission to exhume this body.
Dr. Case is on questionable legal ground, and her credibility is on the line.
I have never done anything like that before. But I was doing it in the belief that I would be able to reveal what had happened. So we go to the funeral home. They dig up the casket. And it's taken to my facility. And on the following day, I do the autopsy. That autopsy is done in the presence of two or three detectives there to photograph and receive the evidence.
The exhumation is illegal, so none of the evidence will be admissible in court.
But I knew that if I got the information I needed, I would then be able to put everything back and then get a legal order and do it again. The body was quite well preserved for the time that she had been underground, which was 3.5 years, right on the button.
She begins examining the exterior injuries to Sharon's body.
The injuries I would expect to see in a motor vehicle collision would have to have some correlation with the damage to the vehicle. So I would expect to see some blunt force injuries on other parts of the body, not limited to just the head, for example.
The only injuries Dr. Case can find are to Sharon's face and head.
On the right side, she had a small superficial laceration, and it had been sutured in the hospital. And then she had some bruising around that area. There is no fracture of that part of the head, but there was a small abrasion right over the left brow. So these areas are consistent with a frontal impact, even if you're wearing a seatbelt. But the big finding was at the back of her head, there were two big vertical lacerations, one in the left, one on the right. And they were in the parietal occipital region. I could tell that they're not consistent with this frontal impact accident.
Dr. Case looks deeper into the wounds, trying to rule out all other possible reasons for the injuries.
We make an incision across the top of the head so that we can see the undersurface of the scalp. When I look now directly at the bone and the soft tissue, what I could see is there was a great deal of hemorrhage surrounding those areas of laceration. So this tells me that there was tremendous impact to the back of the head, and that had created skull fracture and internal head injury that had caused her to die. So that's not consistent with this motor vehicle accident. And there's no explanation in the car that could provide another mechanism for how she died. So I get back with the detective and I say, well, I think you've got a homicide here.
When Dr. Mary Case made a determination that Sharon had died as a result of a homicide, it took me right back to the night of the accident. It was unfortunate that she died in the way that she died, but it made me feel good that I was, in fact, right.
3.5 years after the fact, detectives reopened Sharon's case as a murder investigation and turned their attention to Sharon's husband, Jim Williams.
Most people don't get murdered by strangers. The likelihood is that if you're going to get murdered, the chances are that you are going to have some kind of connection with the individual. So as an investigator, you always start at home and you work your way out.
Jim Williams was a very well-known gentleman, just a big teddy bear of a guy.
Jim was a really well-respected electrical contractor. He was friends with a lot of business people, a lot of judges, a lot of politicians. So anybody who wanted a vote, they wanted Jim to get out there and support him. And that's what he did. After Sharon died, Jim expressed grief, and then eventually married Joanne.
Detectives soon discover a curious connection in Joanne's personal history. Before she married Jim, she was married to a man named Walter Scott.
Walter Scott was reported as a missing person approximately 2 months after Sharon Williams' incident.
Is it unusual for people to just up and disappear? In St. Charles County, that's not something that happens every day.
Detectives suspect Sharon's death and Walter's disappearance are connected. They're determined to get to the bottom of the story.
If you're coming into that investigation, you now look at that sort of unit of people who have unexplained car accidents and the spouse going missing.
Coincidences don't exist in law enforcement. They just don't exist.
While searching for Sharon Williams' killer, investigators uncover another mysterious cold case, the disappearance of Walter Scott.
It was right around Christmas time. Joanne Notice had reported her husband missing. Her husband was Walter Notice, or also known as Walter Scott, which was a stage name.
Walter was the lead singer of Bob Cuban and the M-Men. He had stage presence. The women loved him, and Joanne really loved him.
I can still see him getting out of his 1955 Chevy. He came up and sang a couple songs, and I hired him right away. I said, man, I need a lead singer, and you're exactly what I'm looking for.
I love to hear him sing. My husband and I always went to see him all the time.
Walter disappeared in 1983 at the height of the band's popularity.
We're going to be doing a big concert at the Fox Theater, which is a big venue here in St. Louis. But then, of course, as you well know, all hell broke loose.
The night that Walter went missing, Joanne said she came into the kitchen and said, you need to go up to the garage, you need to get the paperwork done on the car. So he got on his coat, his shoes, and he told the kids he'll be back in a little bit, and he left the house. And he never came back. Nobody had ever seen him after that. Joanne wanted to file a police report at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and they said it's too soon.
You have to be missing 24 hours in the state of Missouri before you're reported missing as an adult.
So about 7 o'clock that morning, the sheriff came to the house where Walter and Joanne lived, and she made out a missing persons report. It was very odd that Joanne would immediately wanted to do a missing persons report, because anybody who knew Walter knew there were times he would say, I'm going to go out, I'm going to get a pack of cigarettes, I'm going to visit a friend. And he would be gone for the rest of the night. He may not come in until about 10 o'clock the next morning. So for her to call the sheriff to make a missing persons report was very unusual.
If a person wants to project the face of innocence, they'll do many different things to try and make it seem as if they are not involved in the crime. One of the things they might do is call the police and stage a scene that makes it seem as if they are worried about a loved one who's gone missing.
The police called. They said they were looking for him, but they didn't know where he was at, wanted to know if he's home. And I said, no, he wasn't here. That was a shocker, because it was winter time and it was so cold out. I didn't know where he could be.
There wasn't much of an effort to find Walter at that point because people thought he was still in the area.
Detectives weren't suspicious at the time because none of this was out of character for a musician who traveled around the country.
The fact that he was on the road with the band so much, I thought he was just getting tired of the situation playing at gigs around here, and he took off again.
So they said, okay, let's take a look at the airport.
In Joanne's attempts to locate her missing husband, she sent some friends over to the airport to see if his car may be over there. And as I understand it, they had in fact found his car at the airport.
They opened up the trunk, they opened up the car, and there's nothing there.
We didn't know if he had just left the area and was living under an assumed name, or if there was more criminal activity taking place in that disappearance.
Without the context of Sharon's murder, detectives searched for other suspects farther afield.
Walter liked to associate with the dark side of people. Gangsters, people with questionable backgrounds, kind of a rough crowd. He was also a womanizer. Sometimes, I guess it was boyfriends or husbands, didn't like the fact that maybe he was having a brief affair with their wife.
It was rumored that he was quite the ladies' man. That was an avenue that we followed to see if it was possibly a jealous husband.
people talk about it. Everybody's got an ideal of what they think happened, where he might be. From being out of the country playing in a band somewhere to being dumped in the Missouri River. We just heard a lot of different theories on where people thought Walter was at.
There was an extensive investigation done across the country. But without a body, we cannot conduct a criminal investigation.
But Walter's mother never bought any of it.
Wally would have never, never went off without telling me he was leaving. Never.
Investigators suspect that Walter's disappearance and Sharon's death are part of a larger conspiracy.
With the timing of all of it, you have to look at it with very, very, very suspicious glasses.
They start putting the pieces together. Jim's former wife, Sharon, dies in a staged car accident.
So Sharon's death, I believe that there was a linear blunt object, and I don't know what it is, but it was struck twice. She is a victim of a homicide, meaning that someone caused her death.
Then, within months, the woman Jim later marries loses her husband, Walter, to a sudden disappearance.
So if Jim and Joanne were having an affair before Sharon died, and neither one of them felt that they could get out of their marriage, it puts a whole new light on this case.
Investigators scour Walter's original missing persons report, looking for any connection to Sharon Williams. What they find is startling.
Joanne Notice had reported her husband missing around Christmas time. And when the deputy arrived at the house, during the course of his investigation, he identified a gentleman that was at the house by the name of Jim Williams.
With the revelation that Jim was in Joanne's house the morning she filed the missing persons report, detectives believe they've uncovered the motive driving both cases. Now they need to prove it. Investigators suspect Sharon's husband, Jim, and Walter's wife, Joanne, were having an affair prior to Sharon's death.
When an investigator becomes aware of information that would suggest that one of the two parties was having an extramarital affair, that changes the dynamic of the investigation. Is there a motivation for that person to kill one or the other of the spouses? Because maybe there's a fear that their role in the affair is going to come out to their spouse. So there's all kinds of motivations.
Detectives canvass the neighborhood, looking for confirmation.
The neighbors around where Joanne and Walter lived knew about the affair that Joanne was having with Jim. Jim saw a lot of Joanne. He gave her jewelry and clothes and books of poetry. He was wooing her.
Why those people never came forward, why those people never said anything is beyond me.
Detectives realized that the people closest to Walter had suspicions at the time.
A day after he went missing, Walter's parents went over to Wally's house. And when they walked in the door, there was Jim Williams in the kitchen looking at Walter's jewelry. And they said, "What is he doing here? What are you doing with my son's jewelry?" And about this time, too, is when Joanne started canceling all of Walter's future gigs. There was a big place in the Poconos that he was playing for New Year's Eve, and that was going to bring the most money he ever had made. And she canceled this. People say, "Why are you canceling these shows? We don't even know, he might come back."
The winter time was bad, and I kept thinking, where is he at? Where could we find him? my husband and I, we looked and we looked. We would go up by his house and see if we could find somebody, something. But we never did. It was horrible. I didn't talk to Joanne at all. I didn't visit with her. She didn't come to the house, and I didn't go.
Detectives are convinced of Joanne and Jim's complicity in Sharon's murder and Walter's disappearance. But to prove it, they need to find Walter's body.
Disposing of a human body is not an easy thing to do. And you can't just put them into a garbage bag and put them out with the trash. It's one of the things that killers don't think about when they commit murders. And generally, that's where they make their mistakes.
At that point, the sheriff decides they were going to go down to Florida to talk to Jim Williams' older son, Jimmy Jr. He's in prison down there, and they told him that his mother was murdered. It wasn't the car accident that killed her. She was murdered.
They came right out and said, "We suspect your father, Jim Williams, had some role in this. And there is a second doubt that we suspect that he had a role in, and that is Walter Scott." Well, of course, it was shocking to hear this. But he and his dad don't get along. He's directly asked, if your father had a dead body, meaning Walter, what would he do with it?
And he said, well, did you look at my dad's cistern?
My cistern is used to store water that's pumped out of the ground. It's got a round concrete top. But it's like 10, 12 feet in circumference, and it's all brick, and it just goes down 20 feet.
In the month of December 1984, his father, Jim Williams, had a flower pot built over top of a cistern in the backyard of the residence. And it just seemed odd at that time of the year when it was freezing temperatures that he would have someone out there building this flower box.
If Walter's body is where they suspect it is, detectives could be on the brink of solving both Sharon's case and Walter's in one fell swoop.
Search warrant was obtained for the Williams residence and the cistern that was located in the rear yard.
They call me, it's nighttime, and they want me to come. And as soon as I get to the neighborhood, it's lit up like a circus. It was an amazing scene.
Well, they had the mobile lights, and they had a lot of deputies to help them. And that's when they started to move the cistern. It was encased in concrete.
They have moved the cover over, and they want me to come there and look at this. Nobody knew what we were going to see.
When they introduced light into the cistern, they could see and tell that that was, in fact, a body. In the bottom, in a blue jogging suit.
Was the exact outfit that Walter Scott was reported as wearing when he went missing.
One of the policemen donned waders, and they had the rope and went 9 feet down. They did find a plastic bag, and that contained the identification of Walter Scott.
Detectives are hoping Walter's body will lead them to his killer. but only if they can get it out of the hole without destroying vital evidence.
When we have bodies that are in cold, wet, or watery places, we have a special kind of decomposition that the body goes through. We call it adipocere. The shape of the body is preserved, but it's almost like bread. It kind of crumbles if you touch it. It makes it more difficult, and it's very fragile, and there is no skin anymore. The skin is long gone. And bones are being exposed. I was so afraid that we wouldn't be able to get the body out.
Detectives have found Walter Scott's badly decomposed body in the bottom of a cistern on Jim Williams' property. Dr. Case needs to get it to the morgue without destroying it in the process.
I get down on my hands and knees, and with my bare hands, because we didn't have any gloves, I took the skull out of the water, and we wrapped it in a sheet. The head was disarticulated, and there was actually six of the cervical vertebrae were still attached to the skull, and I just wanted to hold it very gently to preserve it. The rest of the body is floating in a horizontal fashion. He had a rope that had tied his hands together, and the same rope went around his thighs and legs, and then five times around the ankles.
The body is sent to the morgue to determine cause of death.
They take the x-rays, and we can see immediately that there is a gunshot wound in the chest. Specifically, we can tell that it's a rifle. This is not a handgun. This is a high-velocity gun because it has made a pattern of bullet breakdown in the body that we refer to as a snowstorm. And I would say, even though I can't prove this, it is much more likely that he was tied up after he was shot to make him easier to move. So he's in that cistern, he's tied up, he's got a bullet wound. That is a homicide. That's not a suicide. He didn't die of natural or accidental means.
With Jim Williams now firmly linked to both Sharon Williams and Walter Scott's murder, detectives finally have enough for an arrest warrant.
With the recovery of Walter Scott's body out of the cistern on property owned by Jim Williams, and the fact that Jim's wife's motor vehicle accident was considered to be a homicide, the information was presented to the prosecutor's office. They convened a grand jury, and Jim was indicted on two counts of murder.
But detectives don't think Jim acted alone.
You have to have someone driving Sharon's car, and then driving Jim Williams back to his home after the vehicle was put in the ditch. You have to have someone driving Walter's car to the airport, and you have to have someone picking that person up from the airport.
Police believe that person is Jim's wife, Joanne, but they don't have enough evidence to charge her with murder.
Joanne was charged with hindering the prosecution.
This case pretty much racked up to be a love triangle situation.
Joanne said that Walter would not give her a divorce. And Jim didn't want to get a divorce from Sharon because he had a very successful business and he did not want to have Sharon have any part of taking all the money away from him.
It's pretty much assumed that Jim Williams killed his first wife and then staged the accident and then killed Walter Scott and disposed of that body to enable him and Joanne to live happily ever after.
Dr. Case details her findings at the trial of Jim Williams.
I bought a special white suit. And I've never done anything like that before. It was like, okay, I'm the voice of justice here, and I'm going to have my special white suit. The key to the case had to be the first death, which was the motor vehicle accident, had to be recognized as a homicide. I don't think Walter's case would ever have been solved without Sharon. In Sharon's case, I believe that there was a linear blunt object struck twice. In the case of Walter, he died as a result of the gunshot wound in the chest.
Without the medical examiner's office, this case would have gone down as just a fatality motor vehicle crash and a missing persons case that would never have been solved. With Dr. Case's credentials and her ability, she was able to determine the exact cause of death and lead us to a final resolution.
In November of 1992, Jim Williams is convicted of the murders of both Sharon Williams and Walter Scott.
He was found guilty, and then he was sent to the Potosi, maximum security prison in Missouri, and he was given life without parole.
His wife, Joanne Notice Williams, is also sent to prison.
It was determined that she was involved in some aspect of the disappearance of her husband, and she was found guilty of a much lesser crime, and she was sentenced to 5 years in the Missouri Department of Corrections. She spent a very short period of time incarcerated and was released on parole.
It's a bittersweet moment for family and friends.
That didn't solve anything. That didn't bring Wally back. But it was a relief when we found his body and we could bury him. And I knew where he was at then. So I know he's resting. I never got to see him, though. Never got to see him.
Forensic pathology is the voice of the dead to speak to the living about what happened. And I do take great pride in doing that.